capable of continuing, might have enabled me to live in opulence, even in luxury, if only I had been disposed to combine, in the smallest degree, an author's tricks with carefulness to produce good books. But I felt that writing for bread would soon have stifled my genius and destroyed my talents, which were more those of the heart than of the pen, and arose solely from a proud and elevated manner of thinking, which alone could support them. Nothing great, nothing vigorous, can proceed from a pen that is entirely venal. Necessity, perhaps avarice, might have led me to write with greater rapidity than excellence. If the need of success had not plunged me into cabals, it might have made me strive to say what might please the multitude, rather than what was true and useful. And instead of a distinguished author, which I might possibly become, I should have ended in becoming nothing but a mere scribbler. No, no. I've always felt that the position of an author is not and cannot be distinguished or respectable, except in so far as it is not a profession. It is too difficult to think nobly when one thinks only in order to live. In order to be able and to venture to utter great truths, one must not be dependent upon success. I threw my books amongst the public with the sure consciousness of having spoken for the general good, without caring for anything else. If the work was rejected, so much the worse for those who refused to profit by it. As for myself, I did not. My profession would support me if my books did not sell, and it was just this which made them sell. It was on the 9th of April, 1756, that I left Paris, never to live in a city again, for I do not reckon the brief periods for which I afterwards stayed in Paris, London, and other cities, only when passing through them, or against my will. Madame d'Épinay took us all three in her carriage, her farmer took charge of my small amount of luggage, and I was installed in my new home the same day. I found my little retreat arranged and furnished simply, but neatly and even tastefully. The hand which had attended to these arrangements conferred upon them in my eyes an inestimable value, and I found it delightful to be the guest of my friend in a house of my own choice, which she had built on purpose for me. Although it was cold and there was still some snow on the ground, the earth was beginning to show signs of vegetation. Violets and primroses could be seen, the buds were beginning to open on the trees, and the night of my arrival was marked by the first song of the nightingale, which I heard nearly under my window, in a wood adjoining the house. When I awoke, after a light sleep, forgetting my change of abode, I thought that I was still in the Rue de Grenelle, when suddenly this warbling made me start, and in my delight I exclaimed, "At last all my wishes are fulfilled." My first thought was to abandon myself to the impression caused by the rural objects by which I was surrounded. Instead of beginning to set things in order in my new abode, I began by making arrangements for my walks. There was not a path, not a copse, not a thicket, not a corner round my dwelling which I had not explored by the following day. The more I examined this charming retreat, the more I felt that it was made for me. This spot, solitary rather than wild, transported me in spirit to the end of the world. It possessed those impressive beauties which are rarely seen in the neighbourhood of cities. No one who had suddenly been transported there would have believed that he was only 4 leagues from Paris. After having devoted some days to my rustic enthusiasm, I began to think about putting my papers in order and distributing my occupations. I set aside my mornings for copying, as I had always done, and my afternoons for walking, armed with my little notebook and pencil. For, as I had never been able to write or think freely, except sub divo, I felt no temptation to change my method, and I reckoned that the forest of Montmorency, which was almost at my door, would in future be my study. Sub divo means in the open air. I had several works already begun, and I went over them again. I was magnificent enough in my schemes, but amidst the bustle of the city they had hitherto made but little progress. I counted upon being able to give a little more attention to them when I should have less to distract me. I think that I have fairly fulfilled this expectation, and for a man who was often ill, often at La Chevrette, Epinay, Aubonne, and the Chateau of Montmorency, often beset in his own house by curious idlers, and always busy half the day in copying, if one counts and considers the work which I produced during the 6 years spent at the Hermitage and Montmorency, I am convinced that it will be agreed that, if I lost my time during this period, it was at least not wasted in idleness. Of the different works which I had on the stocks, the one which I had long had in my head, at which I worked with the greatest inclination, to which I wished to devote myself all life, and which, in my own opinion, was to set the seal upon my reputation, was my Institution Politique. 13 or 14 years ago I had conceived the idea of it, when, during my stay at Venice, I had had occasion to observe the faults of its much-vaunted system of government. Since then my views had become greatly enlarged by the historical study of morals. I had come to see that everything was radically connected with politics, and that, however one proceeded, no people would be other than the nature of its government made it. Thus this great question of the best government possible appeared to me to reduce itself to the following: what kind of government is best adapted to produce the most virtuous, the most enlightened, the wisest, and in short the best people, taking the word best in its widest signification? I thought that I perceived that this question was very closely connected with another, very nearly, although not quite the same. What is the government which, from its nature, always keeps closest to the law? This leads to the question, what is the law? And to a series of questions equally important. I saw that all this led me on to great truths conducive to the happiness of the human race, above all to that of my country, in which I had not found, in the journey I had just made thither, sufficiently clear or correct notions of liberty and the laws to satisfy me. And I believed that this indirect method of communicating them was the best suited to spare the pride of those whom it concerned, and to secure my own forgiveness for having been able to see a little further than themselves. Although I had been already engaged 5 or 6 years upon this work, it was still in a very backward state. Books of this kind require meditation, leisure, and tranquillity. Besides, I worked at it, as the saying is, en bonne fortune, secretly, without communicating my intention to anyone, not even to Diderot. I was afraid that it might appear too foolhardy, considering the age and country in which I wrote, and that the alarm of my friends would embarrass me in its execution. It was the prudent strictness of Duclos in particular that inspired me with this apprehension. As for Diderot, somehow or other all my comments always tended to make me more satirical and caustic than I was naturally inclined to be. This very circumstance hindered me from consulting him in regard to an undertaking in which I desired to employ nothing but the force of argument, without the least trace of irritation or party feeling. The tone which I adopted in this work may be gathered from that of the Contrat Social, which is taken from it. I was not yet sure whether it would be finished in time, and in such a manner as to admit of its being published, during my lifetime. I wished to be able to devote to my subject, without restraint, all the efforts which it demanded of me, for I felt convinced that, as I had no satirical vein, and never desired to be personal, I should always be free from blame, if fairly judged. I naturally desired to employ to the full the right of thinking, which was mine by birth, but always in such a manner as to show respect towards the government under which I lived, without ever disobeying its laws. And while extremely careful not to violate the law of nations, I by no means intended to renounce the advantages it afforded, owing to any considerations of fear. I even confess that, as a stranger and living in France, I found my position advantageous for speaking the truth boldly. I knew well that, If I continued, as I intended, to have nothing printed in the state without permission, I was under no responsibility to anyone as regarded my principles and their publication in any other country. I should have been less independent even at Geneva, where the authorities had the right to criticize the contents of my writings wherever they might have been printed. This consideration had greatly contributed to make me yield to the entreaties of Madame d'Épinay, and to abandon my intention of settling at Geneva. I felt, as I have stated in my Émile, that unless a man is a born intriguer, he must by no means compose his books in the bosom of his country, if he desires to devote them to its welfare. What made me feel still happier was that I was persuaded that the government of France, without perhaps regarding me with a very favourable eye, would make it a point of honour, if not to protect me, at least to leave me unmolested. This appeared to me a very simple, but nevertheless very clever, stroke of policy, to make a merit of tolerating what could not be prevented, since if I had been driven from France, which was all the authorities had a right to do, my books would have been written just the same, and perhaps with less reserve, whereas, by leaving me undisturbed, they would keep the author as surety for his works, and further would abolish prejudices deeply rooted in the rest of Europe, by gaining the reputation of having an enlightened respect for the rights of nations. Those who judge, from the result, that my confidence deceived me, may be deceived themselves. In the storm which has overwhelmed me, my books have served as an excuse. But it was against myself personally that the attack was directed. They cared little about the author, but were eager to ruin Jean-Jacques. And the worst thing that could be found in my writings was the honour which they might possibly pay me. But let us not anticipate the future. I do not know whether this mystery, for such it still is to me, will subsequently be cleared up in the eyes of my readers. I only know that if my publicly declared principles had deserved to bring upon me the treatment I have suffered, I should have become its victim sooner. Since the treatment of all my writings, in which these principles are unfolded, with the greatest hardihood, not to say audacity, appeared to have produced its effect even before my retirement to the Hermitage, without it having occurred to anyone, I will not say to pick a quarrel with me, but even to hinder the publication of the work in France, where it was sold as openly as in Holland. Afterwards the Nouvelle Héloïse appeared with no greater difficulty, and I venture to say with the same approval. And what seems almost incredible, the profession of faith of this same Héloïse is exactly the same as that of the Savoyard vicar. All that is outspoken in the Contrat Social had formerly appeared in the Discours sur l'Inégalité. All that is outspoken in Émile had formerly appeared in Julie. But these outspoken passages created no outcry against the two earlier works, therefore it could not have been they which created it against the latter. Another undertaking much of the same nature, the idea of which had occurred to me later, occupied my attention more at this moment. This was selections from the works of the Abbé de Saint-Pierre, of whom I have hitherto been unable to speak, having been carried away by the thread of my narrative. The idea had been suggested to me after my return from Geneva by the Abbé de Mably, not directly, but through the intervention of Madame Dupin, who had a sort of interest in getting me to take it up. She was one of the three or four pretty women of Paris whose spoilt child the old Abbé had been, and if she had not decidedly enjoyed the preference, she had at least shared it with Madame d'Aiguillon. She preserved for the memory of the good old man a feeling of respect and affection which did honour to both, and her vanity would have been flattered by seeing the still-born works of her friend brought to life again by her secretary. These works themselves, however, contained some excellent things, but so badly expressed that it was a wearisome undertaking to read them. and it is astonishing that the Abbé, who regarded his readers merely as grown-up children, should nevertheless have addressed them as men, to judge by the little trouble he took to gain a hearing from them. With this idea, the task had been proposed to me, as useful in itself, and very suitable for a man who was an industrious worker, but idle as an originator, who, finding the effort of thinking very fatiguing, preferred, in things which were to his taste, to elucidate and advance the ideas of another to creating ideas of his own. Besides, as I did not confine myself to the part of a mere translator, I was not prohibited from sometimes thinking for myself, and I was at liberty to give my work such a form that many important truths might find their way into it under the mantle of the Abbé de Saint-Pierre, with less risk than under my own. In addition, the undertaking was no light one. It was a question of nothing less than reading, thinking over, and making selections from 23 volumes, diffuse, confused, full of prolixities, repetitions, and narrow or false views, amongst which it was necessary to fish out some few that were great and lofty, which gave one the courage to endure the painful task. I myself was often on the point of relinquishing it, if I could have drawn back with decency. But by accepting the Abbé's manuscripts, which were given to me by his nephew, the Comte de Saint-Pierre, at the entreaty of Saint-Lambert, I had in a manner pledged myself to make use of them, and it was necessary for me either to return them or to endeavour to turn them to account. It was with the latter intention that I'd brought these manuscripts to the Hermitage, and it was the first work to which I intended to devote my spare time. I contemplated a third work, the idea of which was due to certain observations which I had made upon myself, and I felt the more encouraged to undertake it, as I had reason to hope that I might produce a book really useful to mankind, even one of the most useful that could be offered to it, if the execution worthily corresponded to the plan which I had sketched for myself. The observation has been made that most men, in the course of their lives, are frequently unlike themselves and seem transformed into quite different men. It was not to establish a truth so well known that I desired to write a book. I had a newer and even more important object. This was to investigate the causes of these changes, confining myself to those which depended on ourselves, in order to show how we might ourselves control them, in order to make ourselves better and more certain of ourselves. For it is unquestionably more difficult for an honourable man to resist desires, already fully formed, which he ought to overcome, than it is to prevent, change, or modify these same desires at the fountainhead, supposing him to be in a position to trace them back to it. A man resists temptation at one time because he is strong, another time he yields to it because he is weak. If he had been the same as before, he would not have yielded. While examining myself and endeavouring to find, in the case of others, upon what these different conditions of being depended, I discovered that they depended in great part upon the impression which external objects had previously made upon us, and that we, being continually modified by our senses and our bodily organs, exhibited, without perceiving it, the effect of these modifications of ourselves in our ideas, our feelings, and even in our actions. The numerous and striking observations which I had collected were unassailable, and, from their physical principles, seemed to me well adapted to furnish an external rule of conduct, which, being altered according to circumstances, might place or keep the mind in the condition most favourable to virtue. From how many errors would the reason be preserved, how many vices would be strangled at their birth, if mankind knew how to compel the animal economy to support the moral order, which it so frequently disturbs? Different climates, seasons, sounds, colours, darkness, light, the elements, food, noise, silence, movement, repose, all affect the bodily machine and consequently the mind, all afford us 1,000 opportunities, which will almost infallibly enable us to govern those feelings in their first beginnings, by which we allow ourselves to be dominated. Such was the fundamental idea which I had already sketched upon paper, and from which I expected, in the case of well-disposed persons, who, loving virtue sincerely, mistrust their weakness, a surer effect, inasmuch as it appeared easy to me to make of it a book as agreeable to read as it was to write. However, I have made but little progress in the work, the title of which was La Morale Sensitive, or Le Matérialisme du Sage. Distractions, the cause of which the reader will soon learn, prevented me from giving it attention, and he will also learn what was the fate of my sketch, which is more closely connected with my own than it might appear. Besides all this, I had for some time contemplated a system of education, to which Madame de Chenonceaux, who trembled for her son's future, as the result of the education which he was receiving from his father, had begged me to give attention. The power of friendship caused this subject, although less to my taste in itself, to claim my attention more than all the rest. For this reason, this is the only project, amongst all those which I've just mentioned, that I've carried out. The object which I propose to myself in this work should, in my opinion, have brought the author a different reward. But let us not here anticipate this melancholy topic. I shall have only too much reason to speak of it in the sequel. All these various projects afforded me material for meditation during my walks, for, as I believe I have already said, I can only think while walking. As soon as I stop, I can think no longer. My brain can only move with my feet. However, I had taken the precaution of providing myself with an indoor task for rainy days. This was my Dictionary of Music, the scattered, mutilated, and raw materials of which made it necessary to rewrite the work almost entirely. I bought some books which I required for the purpose. I had spent 2 months in making extracts from a number of others which I borrowed from the King's Library, and some of which I was even allowed to take with me to the Hermitage. These were my materials for compiling indoors when the weather did not allow me to go out, or when I was tired of my copying. This arrangement suited me so well that I adhered to it, both at the Hermitage and at Montmorency, and even subsequently at Moutier, where I finished this work while continuing others. And I always found a real relaxation in a change of occupation. I followed for some time, with tolerable exactness, the distribution of time that I'd marked out for myself, and was very well satisfied with it. But when the fine weather brought back Madame d'Épinay more frequently to Épinay or La Chevrette, I found that attentions, which at first did not cost me much, but which I had not reckoned upon, greatly upset my other arrangements. I have already said that Madame d'Épinay had some very amiable qualities. She was very devoted to her friends and served them most zealously. And, as she spared neither time nor trouble, she certainly deserved that they should show her some attentions in return. Hitherto I had fulfilled this duty without feeling that it was one, but at last I discovered that I'd loaded myself with a chain, the weight of which only friendship prevented me from feeling. I had made the burden heavier by my dislike of crowded rooms. Madame d'Épinay availed herself of this to make a proposal, which seemed to suit me well, and suited her even better. This was that she should let me know when she would be alone, or nearly so. I consented, without foreseeing to what I was binding myself. The consequence was that I no longer visited her when it was convenient to me, but when it suited her, so that I was never sure of having a whole day at my disposal. This tie considerably spoiled the pleasure which my visits to her had formerly afforded me. I found that the freedom which she had so often promised me was only granted to me on condition that I never made use of it, and when once or twice I attempted to do so, it gave occasion to so many messages, so many notes, and such apprehensions concerning my health, that I plainly saw that nothing but being completely confined to my bed could excuse me from running to her at the first intimation of her wishes. I was obliged to submit to this yoke. I submitted, and with tolerably good grace, for so bitter an enemy of dependence as I was, since my sincere attachment to her prevented me in great measure from feeling the chain which accompanied it. She also filled up in this manner, more or less, the void which the absence of her usual circle left in her amusements. It was for her a very poor stop-gap, but it was better than complete solitude, which was unbearable to her. However, she was able to fill it much more easily after she began to try her hand at literature, and took it into her head to write, no matter how, romances, letters, comedies, tales, and such trifles. But what amused her was not so much writing as reading them, and if she by chance managed to scribble two or three consecutive pages, it was absolutely necessary for her to feel sure of having at least two or three favourable hearers when she had completed this enormous task. I rarely had the honour of being one of the chosen, except by the favour of another. By myself I was hardly ever considered at all in anything, not only in the society of Madame d'Epinay, but in that of Monsieur d'Holbach, and wherever Grimm set the fashion. This complete insignificance suited me perfectly well, except in a tête-à-tête, when I did not know what attitude to assume, as I did not venture to talk about literature, of which I was not competent to judge, nor about gallantry, since I was too bashful, and I feared, more than death itself, the ridiculous appearance of an old beau. Besides, this idea never occurred to me when with Madame d'Epinay, and would perhaps never have occurred to me once in my life, even had I spent it altogether in her society. Not that I had any personal repugnance to her. On the contrary, I perhaps loved her too much as a friend, to be able to love her as a lover. It gave me pleasure to see her and to talk with her. Her conversation, although agreeable enough in society, was dull in private. My own, which was by no means fluent, was not much assistance to her. Ashamed of a too lengthy silence, I strained every nerve to enliven the interview, and although it often tired me, it never wearied me. I was very glad to show her trifling attentions, to give her little brotherly kisses, which did not appear to excite her sensuality any more than my own, and that was all. She was very thin, very pale. Her breast was as flat as my hand. This defect alone would have been sufficient to chill me. My heart and senses have never been able to see a woman in one who has no breasts, and other reasons, which it would be useless to mention, always caused me to forget her sex. Having thus made up my mind to an inevitable servitude, I resigned myself to it without resistance, and found it, at least during the first year, less burdensome than I should have expected. Madame d'Epinay, who usually spent the whole summer in the country, only spent part of the summer of this year there, either because her affairs required her to be more at Paris, or because the absence of Grimm rendered her stay at La Chevrette less agreeable. I profited by the intervals of her absence, or when she had much company, to enjoy my solitude with my good Thérèse and her mother in a manner which made me thoroughly appreciate it. Although for some years I had visited the country pretty frequently, I had rarely enjoyed it, and those excursions, always taken in the company of pretentious persons, and always spoiled by a feeling of restraint, only whetted my appetite for country pleasures, and, the nearer the glimpse I had of them, the more I felt the want of them. I was so weary of salons, waterfalls, groves, flower gardens, and their still more wearisome exhibitors. I was so tired of stitching, pianos, sorting wool, making bows, foolish witticisms, insipid affectations, trifling storytellers, and big suppers, that when I caught a glimpse of a simple thorn bush, a hedge, a barn, or a meadow, when I inhaled, while passing through a hamlet, the fragrance of a savoury Churville omelette, when I heard from a distance the rustic refrain of the bisquière, these are the female goat-herds, I wished all rouge, furbelows, and ambergris at the devil. ambergris was used for perfume. And, regretting the good wife's homely dinner and the native wine, I should have been delighted to slap the face of Monsieur le Chef and Monsieur le Maître, who forced me to dine at my usual supper hour, and to sup at a time when I am usually asleep. Above all, I should have liked to slap Messieurs les Lacrais, who devoured with their eyes the morsels I ate, and if I was not prepared to die of thirst, sold me their master's adulterated wine at 10 times the price I should have paid for wine of a better quality at an inn. Behold me then at last in my own house, in a pleasant and solitary retreat, able to spend my days in the independent, even, and peaceful life, for which I felt that I was born. Before describing the effect of this situation, so new to me, upon my heart, it behoves me to recapitulate its secret inclinations, that the progress of these new modifications may be better followed up in its origin. I have always considered the day which united me to my Thérèse as that which determined my moral being. I needed an attachment, since that which should have sufficed me had been so cruelly broken. The thirst for happiness is never quenched in man's heart. Mamma was growing old and degraded. It was clear to me that she could never again be happy in this world. Thus, the only thing left for me was to seek for a happiness which should be my own, since I had for ever lost all hope of sharing hers. I drifted for some time from one idea, from one plan, to another. My voyage to Venice would have plunged me into public affairs, if the man with whom I was to be connected had been possessed of common sense. I am easily discouraged, especially in difficult and long-winded undertakings. My ill success in this disgusted me with all others, and since, in accordance with my old maxim, I looked upon distant objects as decoys for fools, I determined to live henceforth without any fixed plan, as I no longer saw anything in life which might have tempted me to exert myself. It was just at that time that we became acquainted. The gentle character of this good girl appeared to me so well suited to my own, that I united myself to her by means of an attachment which neither time nor wrongs have been able to lessen, and everything which ought to have broken it has only increased it. The strength of this attachment will be seen in the sequel, when I lay bare the wounds and pangs with which she has rent my heart during the height of my misery, without a word of complaint to anyone ever escaping me, until the moment when I am writing these lines. When it becomes known that, after having done all and braved everything to avoid being separated from her, after having lived with her for 25 years, in spite of destiny and mankind, I finally married her in my old age, without any expectation or solicitation on her part, without any engagement or promise on my own, it will be believed that a mad love, which turned my head from the first day, gradually led me on to the last extravagance. And it will be the more readily believed when the special and weighty reasons which should have prevented me from ever doing such a thing also become known. What, then, will the reader think when I declare to him, in all the sincerity which he must now recognize as part of my character, that from the first moment when I saw her up to this day, I never felt the least spark of love for her, that I no more desired her possession than that of Madame de Warens, and that the sensual needs, which I satisfied in her person, were only for me those of sexual impulse, without being in any way connected with the individual. He will perhaps believe that, being constituted differently from other men, I was incapable of feeling love, since it did not enter into the feelings which attached me to those women who have been most dear to me. Patience, reader. The fatal moment is approaching, when you will be only too rudely undeceived. I repeat myself, I know it, but it is unavoidable. The first, the greatest, the most powerful, the most irrepressible of all my needs was entirely in my heart. It was the need of a companionship as intimate as was possible. It was for that purpose especially that I needed a woman rather than a man, a female rather than a male friend. This singular want was such that the most intimate corporal union had been unable to satisfy it. I should have wanted two souls in the same body. Without that, I was always conscious of a void. I thought that the moment had come when I should feel it no longer. This young person, amiable by reason of a thousand excellent qualities, and at that time even by her personal appearance, which was without a trace of unnaturalness or coquetry, would have confined my whole existence in herself, if I had been able to confine hers to me as I'd hoped. I had nothing to fear from men. I am certain that I am the only man she ever truly loved, and her passions were so cool that she rarely felt the want of other men, even when I had ceased to be one to her in this respect. I had no family. She had one. And this family, the members of which were all of a far different character from herself, was not such that I could ever have regarded it as my own. This was the first cause of my unhappiness. What would I not have given to have been able to make myself her mother's child? I tried all I could to do so, but never succeeded. It was useless for me to attempt to unite all our interests. It was impossible. She always created interests different from mine, set them in opposition to mine, and even to those of her daughter, which were already identical with them. She and her other children and grandchildren became so many leeches, and the least injury they did to Thérèse was that of robbing her. The poor girl, who was accustomed to give in, even to her nieces, allowed herself to be robbed and ruled without saying a word. And it pained me to see that while I exhausted my money and good advice in vain, I could do nothing to assist her. I tried to get her away from her mother, but she always opposed it. I respected her opposition, and esteemed her the more for it. But this refusal was none the less prejudicial to her interests and my own. Devoted to her mother and the rest of her family, she belonged more to them than to me, even more than to herself. Their greed was not so ruinous to her as their advice was pernicious. In short, if, thanks to her love for me and her naturally good disposition, she was not completely their slave, she was sufficiently so to prevent, in great part, the effect of the good principles which I endeavoured to instil into her, and to cause us always to remain two, in spite of all my efforts to the contrary. Thus it came to pass that, notwithstanding a sincere and mutual attachment, upon which I had bestowed all the tenderness of my heart, the void in this heart was never completely filled. Children, who might have effected this, were born to us, but this only made matters worse. I shuddered at the thought of handing them over to the care of this badly brought-up family, to be brought up even worse. The risks of bringing up at the Foundling Hospital were far less. This reason for the resolution which I took, stronger than all those which I stated in my letter to Madame de Franqueuil, was, however, the only one which I did not venture to tell her. I preferred to remain not completely cleared from so grave a reproach, in order to spare the family of a person whom I loved. But it may be judged, from the behaviour of her miserable brother, whether, in spite of anything that may be said about it, I should have been justified in exposing my children to the risk of receiving a similar education to his. Being unable to enjoy to the full this intimate intercourse, of which I felt the need, I sought to supplement it in a manner which, although it did not completely fill the void, caused me to feel it less. For want of a friend who should be entirely devoted to me, I needed friends whose impulse might overcome my indolence. For this reason I cultivated and strengthened my relations with Diderot and the Abbé de Condillac, entered into fresh and still closer relations with Grimm, and in the end, owing to the unlucky essay, the history of which I have related, I found myself thrown back, without any idea of it, upon literature, which I thought I'd abandoned forever. My first appearance led me by a new path into another intellectual world, the simple and lofty economy of which I was unable to look upon without enthusiasm. My continued attention to it soon convinced me that there was nothing but error and folly in the doctrine of our philosophers, and misery and oppression in our social arrangements. Deluded by my foolish pride, I thought that I was born to destroy all these illusions, and believing that, in order to gain a hearing, it was necessary for my manner of life to harmonize with my principles, I adopted the singular course, which I have not been permitted to continue, in which I set an example, for which my pretended friends have never forgiven me, which at first made me ridiculous, and would have ended by making me respectable, if it had been possible for me to persevere in it. Hitherto I had been good. From that moment I became virtuous, or at least intoxicated with virtue. This intoxication had commenced in my head, but had passed on into my heart. The noblest pride sprang up therein on the ruins of uprooted vanity. I pretended nothing. I became really what I seemed. And for the 4 years at least, during which this state of effervescence lasted in all its force, there was nothing great or beautiful which a man's heart could contain, of which I was not capable between heaven and myself. This was the origin of my sudden eloquence, of the truly celestial fire which inflamed me and spread over my first writings, and which for 40 years had not emitted the least spark, since it was not yet kindled. I was truly transformed. My friends and acquaintances no longer recognized me. I was no longer the shy, bashful, rather than modest man, who did not venture to show himself or utter a word, whom a playful remark disconcerted, whom a woman's glance caused to blush. Audacious, proud, undaunted, I carried with me everywhere a confidence which was firmer in proportion to its simplicity, and had its abode rather in my soul than in my outward demeanour. The contempt for the manners, principles, and prejudices of my age, with which my deep meditations had inspired me, rendered me insensible to the raillery of those who possessed them, and I pulverized their trifling witticisms with my maxims, as I should have crushed an insect between my fingers. What a change! All Paris repeated the penetrating and biting sarcasms of the man who, 2 years before and 10 years afterwards, never knew how to find the thing he ought to say, nor the expression he ought to use. Anyone who endeavours to find the condition of all others most contrary to my nature will find it in this. If he desires to recall one of those brief moments in my life, during which I ceased to be myself and became another, he will find it again in the time of which I speak. But instead of lasting 6 days or 6 weeks, it lasted nearly 6 years, and would perhaps have lasted until now, had it not been for the special circumstances which put an end to it, and restored me to nature, above which I had attempted to elevate myself. The change began as soon as I had left Paris, and the sight of the vices of the great city ceased to keep up the indignation with which it had inspired me. As soon as I lost sight of men, I ceased to despise them. As soon as I lost sight of the wicked, I ceased to hate them. My heart, little adapted for hatred, only caused me to deplore their wretchedness, from which it did not distinguish their wickedness. This gentler, but far less lofty, frame of mind soon dulled the burning enthusiasm which had so long carried me away, and without anyone perceiving it, even without perceiving it myself, I became again shy, courteous, and timid. In a word, the same Jean-Jacques as I had been before. If this revolution had merely restored me to myself, and had gone no further, all would have been well. But unfortunately it went much further, and carried me away rapidly to the other extreme. From that time my soul, in a state of agitation, no longer kept its centre of gravity, and its oscillations, ever renewed, always destroyed it. I must describe at some length this second revolution, the terrible and fatal epoch of a destiny without example among mankind. As we were only a party of three in our retreat, leisure and solitude naturally increased the intimacy of our intercourse. This was what occurred in the case of Thérèse and myself. We spent some delightful hours together under the shady trees, more delightful than any I had ever enjoyed before. She herself appeared to appreciate it more than she had hitherto done. She opened her heart to me without reserve, and told me things about her mother and her family, which she had been strong-minded enough to conceal from me for a long time. Both had received from Madame Dupin a number of presents intended for me, which the cunning old woman, to save me annoyance, had appropriated for herself and her other children, without leaving any for Thérèse, whom she strictly forbade to say anything to me about them, a command which the poor girl obeyed with an obedience which is almost incredible. A thing which surprised me still more was the discovery that, besides the secret conversations which Diderot and Grimm had frequently held with both, in order to estrange them from me, but which had failed in their object owing to the opposition of Thérèse, both of them had since then held frequent secret conferences with her mother, without her knowing anything of what was brewing between them. She only knew that sundry little presents played a part in it, that there were little journeys to and fro, which they attempted to conceal from her, of the reason of which she was completely ignorant. At the time when we left Paris, Madame Levasseur had long been in the habit of calling upon Grimm two or three times a month, and spending some time there with him in private conversation, on which occasions even his servant was always sent out of the room. I judged that the motive of all this was no other than the same scheme into which they had attempted to make the daughter entered, by promising to procure for them, through Madame d'Épinay's influence, a license to retail salt, or a tobacco shop. In a word, by tempting them with the prospect of gain. They had represented to these women that, as I was not in a position to do anything for them, I could not do anything for myself either, on account of them. As I saw nothing in all this but good intentions, I was not absolutely annoyed with them. Only the secrecy revolted me, especially on the part of the old woman, who, in addition, daily showed herself more toadying and wheedling in her manner towards me, which, however, did not prevent her from incessantly reproaching her daughter in private with being too fond of me, and telling me everything, saying that she was a fool, and would find herself taken in the end. This woman possessed in the highest degree the art of killing two birds with one stone, of concealing from one what she received from another, and from me what she received from all. I might have pardoned her for her avarice, but I could not forgive her her dissimulation. What could she have to conceal from me whose happiness she so well knew depended almost entirely upon her daughter's happiness and her own? What I had done for her daughter, I had done for myself, but what I had done for her deserved some acknowledgment on her part. She at least should have been grateful to her daughter for it, and should have loved me also out of love for her who loved me. I had rescued her from utter misery. From me she received the means of existence. To me she owed all those acquaintances whom she so well knew how to make use of. Thérèse had long supported her by her own exertions, and was now supporting her with bread supplied by me. She owed all to this daughter, for whom she had done nothing, while her other children, on whom she had bestowed marriage portions, and for whom she had ruined herself, far from helping to support her, devoured her substance and my own. It seemed that, under these circumstances, she should have regarded me as her only friend, as her most reliable protector, and far from keeping me in the dark as to my own affairs, far from joining in a plot against me in my own house, should have faithfully informed me of everything that might concern me when she learned it sooner than I did. In what light, then, could I regard her deceitful and mysterious conduct? Above all, what was I to think of the sentiments with which she endeavoured to inspire her daughter? What monstrous ingratitude must have been the mother's when she sought to instil it into the daughter? All these considerations finally alienated my heart so completely from this woman that I could no longer look upon her without contempt. However, I never ceased to treat the mother of the partner of my life with respect, and to show her in everything almost the consideration and esteem of a son. But I must admit that I never cared to remain long in her company, and I am ill able to put restraint upon myself. This, again, is one of the brief moments of my life in which I have been almost within sight of happiness, without being able to attain to it, although through no fault of my own. If this woman had been of good character, we should, all three, have been happy to the end of our days. The last survivor would alone have deserved pity. Instead of this, the reader will see the development of events, and be able to judge whether I could have altered it. Madame Levasseur, seeing that I'd gained ground in her daughter's heart while she'd lost it, endeavoured to recover it, and instead of regaining my esteem through the daughter, attempted to alienate her from me altogether. One of the means that she employed was to invoke the assistance of her family. I had begged Thérèse not to invite any of them to the Hermitage, and she had promised not to do so. They were invited in my absence, without consulting her, and then they made her promise to say nothing to me about it. When the first step was taken, the rest was easy. When a person once keeps anything secret from one whom he loves, he soon feels no scruple about concealing everything from him. As soon as I was at La Chevrette, the Hermitage was full of people who enjoyed themselves tolerably well. A mother has always great influence over a daughter of good disposition. Nevertheless, in spite of all her efforts, the old woman could never induce Thérèse to enter into her views, or persuade her to join the conspiracy against me. As for herself, she made up her mind irrevocably, as she saw, on the one side, her daughter and myself, at whose house she could live, and that was all, and on the other, Diderot, Grimm, D'Holbach, and Madame d'Épinay, who promised much and gave something. It never entered her head that she could possibly be in the wrong in company with a farmer general's wife and a baron. If I had been more observant, I should have seen, from that moment, that I was nourishing a serpent in my bosom. But my blind confidence, which nothing had as yet diminished, was such that it never even occurred to me that anyone could wish to injure a person who deserved to be loved. While I saw a thousand conspiracies formed around me, all I could complain of was the tyranny of those whom I called my friends, and whose only object, as I imagined, was to force me to be happy in their own fashion rather than in my own. Although Thérèse refused to enter into the conspiracy with her mother, she, again, kept her secret. Her motive was praiseworthy. I will not undertake to decide whether she did well or ill. Two women who have secrets are fond of chattering together about them. This brought them closer together. And Thérèse, by dividing her attentions, sometimes caused me to feel that I was alone, for I could no longer regard as a society the relations between us three. Then it was that I felt keenly the mistake which I had committed, at the beginning of our connection, in not having taken advantage of the pliability which was the result of her affection, to improve her mind and furnish her with a store of knowledge, which, by drawing us closer together in our retirement, would have filled up her time and my own agreeably, and prevented us from ever noticing the length of a tête-à-tête. Not that our conversation ever flagged, or that she showed any signs of weariness during our walks, but we had not a sufficient number of ideas in common to make a great stock. We could no longer speak incessantly of our plans, which henceforth were limited to plans of enjoyment. The objects around us inspired me with reflections which were beyond her comprehension. An attachment of 12 years had no longer need of words. We knew each other too well to be able to find anything fresh. The only resource left was gossip, scandal, and feeble jokes. It is in solitude especially that one feels the advantage of living with someone who knows how to think. I had no need of this resource to amuse myself in her society, but she would have needed it in order to be able always to amuse herself in mine. The worst thing was that we were obliged to hold our interviews secretly. Her mother, who had become a nuisance to me, forced me to look out for opportunities. I felt under restraint in my own house. This is saying everything. The atmosphere of love ruined simple friendship. We enjoyed an intimate intercourse without living in intimacy. As soon as I thought I observed that Thérèse sometimes sought excuses to avoid the walks which I proposed to her, I ceased to propose them, without being annoyed with her for not finding as much pleasure in them as myself. Pleasure does not depend upon the will. I was sure of her affection, and that was enough for me. As long as my pleasures were hers, I enjoyed them with her. When this was not the case, I preferred her contentment to my own. Thus it happened that, half deceived in my expectation, leading a life after my own inclination, in a spot which I had chosen for myself, with a person who was dear to me, I nevertheless at length found myself almost isolated. What I still lacked prevented me from enjoying what I possessed. In the matter of happiness and enjoyment, I must have all or nothing. It will afterwards be seen why I have considered this explanation necessary. I now resume the thread of my narrative. I believed that I possessed a veritable treasure in the manuscripts which the Comte de Saint-Pierre had given me. On examining them more attentively, I found that they were little more than the collection of his uncle's printed works, corrected and annotated by his own hand, together with a few trifling fragments which had never been published. His writings on moral subjects confirm in the idea which some letters from him, which Madame de Crequy had shown me, had given me, that he possessed much greater talent than I'd imagined. But after a thorough examination of his political works, I found nothing but superficial views, or schemes, useful indeed, but rendered impracticable by the idea which the author could never get rid of, that men acted in accordance with their lights rather than their passions. The high opinion of modern learning which he entertained had caused him to adopt this false principle of wisdom brought to perfection, the foundation of all his proposed institutions, and the origin of all his political sophisms. This singular man, an honour to his age and his kind, the only man, perhaps, who, since the human race has existed, has had no other passion than that of reason, nevertheless wandered from one error to another in all his systems, in his desire to make men like himself, instead of taking them as they are, and as they will continue to be. He laboured only for imaginary beings, while believing that he was working for his contemporaries. Recognising all this, I found myself somewhat embarrassed as to the form I should give to my work. By allowing the author's visionary ideas to remain undisturbed, I should render no service. By refuting them rigorously, I should be guilty of discourtesy, since the delivery of his manuscripts, which I had accepted and even asked for, imposed upon me the obligation of treating their author honourably. I finally decided upon the course of action which appeared to me most becoming, most judicious, and most useful. This was to present the author's and my own ideas separately, and with this object to enter into his views, to elucidate them, to enlarge them, and to omit nothing which could secure them full appreciation. My work, therefore, was to be composed of two entirely separate parts. The one was intended to explain, in the manner I have just indicated, the different schemes of the author. In the other, which was not intended to appear until the first had produced its effect, I should have brought my judgment to bear upon these same schemes, which, I confess, might certainly have exposed them sometimes to the fate of the sonnet of the misanthrope. At the commencement of the whole work, I intended to give a life of the author, for which I had collected a quantity of sufficiently good material, which I flattered myself I should be able to make use of without spoiling. I had seen the Abbé de Saint-Pierre two or three times in his old age, and the respect which I had for his memory was a guarantee to me that, upon the whole, Monsieur le Comte would not be dissatisfied with the manner in which I treated his relation. I made my first attempt upon the Paix Perpetuelle, the most important and the most elaborate of all the works which made up the collection, and before I began my reflections upon it, I had the courage to read absolutely everything that the Abbé had written upon this fine subject, without once allowing myself to be discouraged by its prolixity and repetitions. As the public has seen this abstract, I have nothing to say about it. The judgment which I passed upon it has never been printed, and I do not know if it ever will be. But it was written at the same time. I next went on to the Polysynody, or Plurality of Councils, a work written in the Regent's time to support the form of administration which he had introduced, which led to the expulsion of the Abbé from the French Academy, in consequence of certain attacks upon the preceding administration, which irritated the Duchesse de Mayenne and the Cardinal de Polignac. I finished this work in the same manner as the preceding, both abstract and judgment. But I stopped there, as I did not intend to finish this undertaking, which I ought never to have commenced. The consideration which caused me to abandon it presented itself naturally, and it is surprising that it never occurred to me before. Most of the Abbé's writings consisted of, or contained, critical observations upon certain aspects of the French system of government, and some of them were so outspoken that he had reason to congratulate himself upon escaping scot-free. But in the ministerial offices he had always been looked upon as a sort of preacher, rather than as a serious politician, and he was allowed to say what he pleased, because it was well known that nobody would listen to him. If I had succeeded in getting him a hearing, the case would have been different. He was a Frenchman, I was not. And if I repeated his censures, even in his own name, I ran the risk of being asked rudely, but with perfect justice, what I was interfering with. Luckily, before going too far, I saw the handle I was about to give to others against myself, and I speedily withdrew. I knew that, living alone in the midst of men, all more powerful than myself, I should never be able, in spite of all that I could do, to shelter myself from any injury they might choose to inflict upon me. There was only one thing that depended upon myself, to make it impossible for them, should they desire to injure me, to do so without injustice. This principle, which made me give up the Abbé de Saint-Pierre, has frequently caused me to renounce far more